Really important to me. It's like the weather's going to get nicer this weekend. So I think we might dry out finally. We'll see. Hurricane Florence has taken its toll. So today we've got a couple of different things I want to talk about. I just gave you a handout to get ready for your test, which of course will be exactly a week and a minute from right now, right? Minus a minute. So that will be next Friday. I will bring in all the blue books, so you don't have to worry about that. And you'll put all of your answers in the blue books. So I'll talk about this in just a moment. Carly.
I was actually going to ask what a blue book was. But
gotcha.
No.
I'm ahead of you, just for a moment. Okay, so that test should take you the whole time. And the way that I've broken down the test itself is that I will give you five terms out of this list that you have here, and you'll have to answer four of them. And then that will be 80% of your exam. The final 20% of the exam will be like a really large quiz. So I'm not sure if there will be 20 questions or there'll be 17 and a few of them will be worth, but it'll be 20% total, whatever that is. I haven't made it yet. So, and it's going to depend a lot on how far we get on Wednesday. So I won't even make it until Wednesday afternoon just because I've got to see where we're at. So everything you do will be in the blue book, and I'm sure some of you have at least seen these. These are the kinds of things that whenever I'm on a plane and I'm grading, everybody around me groans because everybody who's gone through college has had to suffer through the blue book. But you can see what its size is. It's actually just almost a normal sheet of paper folded over. So if you're thinking about how to answer these, so of the IDs or definitions, whatever you want to call them, I call them identifications, they're terms, but of those, I would assume, and this isn't hard and fast, but I would assume that you would probably, to answer properly, you'd probably want to fill about a page and a half to be able to do that. It's possible you could do it in a shorter amount of time. That's very rare from what I've seen. And you really don't have time to go beyond two pages. And by two pages, I mean on each side of the leaf. Right? So one, two. That's not one, that's two. All right, so just make sure that you get that. So you're going to have roughly about 7 to 8 pages of these really small essays, kind of. So what I expect in these, and we can talk more about this next week. I'm happy to talk anytime you want to about it. And if you're really feeling by Wednesday that you're just not ready, I'm happy to have a study session that night too, but I don't think we'll be, but you guys tell me. Otherwise, I'm going to just assume you're okay. So in those IDs, I want you, if for example, I can give you any one of them, but whatever one I give you, I want you to think of it as, I know nothing at all about this. So I'm asking you, tell me about Abraham. And in that, now you can't always do this, but as I've listed there, the way that we think of answering or defining something is traditionally always the how, what, who, where, when, and why. Right? Just the basic questions. When did it happen? Who was involved? Details that you can give me, the more details you can give me, the better. But I always grade these ultimately, that is the difference between an A and a B on these, is that you are able to explain to me why this thing is important. So, and we've got 16 people in this class, and if I end up with 16 different answers, that's okay. It's not one of those things that has an absolute right or wrong. Some of you are going to focus on Abraham as, yeah, you're going to come from a deeply Christian perspective, and you're going to see this as so vital, the father of all nations. Others of you might just see this as a really important story to understand who we are in the Western tradition. I will never grade you on your views on things like that, politics or religion. It's totally up to you. But I need to know why you think this person is significant. Why is this thing significant? And not any way to sound arrogant at all, and I don't mean to have any hubris about this, but one of the things that you have to learn, and this is just a fact of college, one of the things you have to learn is what quirks your professor has. That's true for anybody. It doesn't matter if you have me or anybody else. So if we go into the test on Friday next week and you're surprised by anything that I've asked, one of us has failed. Either I failed to explain to you something or you failed to take it seriously when I said it. And it can go both ways. Believe me, I've messed up many times in my life, more than I care to count. So it's not, in no way is it something that's absolute. We can talk about that, especially if you disagree with an answer or with something that I ask or the way I grade something, I would encourage you to come see me. If you think there's a problem, I'd be horrified if you just let something slide and you got a worse grade because you didn't deserve it. And that would be the worst thing. So just make sure you come talk to me. But I do want you to know that as you go into something, you know, you've had me now by next week, you will have had me for 5 full weeks. And we're a third of the semester done. So at this point, you should at least get a sense of who I am and what I expect, what's important to me. And I mean that in the sense of, you know, why, part of it was just time, but why did we spend so much time talking about the pre-Socratics? Yeah, that's important. I mean, just ask, well, why would we have done that? Why would the pre-Socratics matter? Wouldn't it have been better to talk about Saul? I mean, we had Saul in the readings too, but we hardly talked about him at all. But we spent tons of time on Heraclitus. So why? And you kind of have to think about that for each professor you have. It's just, you know, whoever it is, she or he, that we've all got our personalities. And there are things that are really important to us and others that aren't. So try and keep that in mind as you're studying. I would also remind you that you are totally welcome in any way, shape, or form to study in any way you want. So if you want to study alone, great. If you want to study with 3 other people, perfect. If you want to study with everybody in this class or everybody in both sections, you know, that would be a little cumbersome, I would think, but you're welcome to do it. The only caveat to all that, of course, is that you have to take your own test. Right? So how you learn it is up to you. Okay, last thing, and then I'll get Shelby on this. Now, this may seem really strange, but there are 2 people in this classroom I have known since they were born. And they're very, very good people, and I know their parents very closely. And so I don't want to know who they are when I'm grading them. I don't want Leo and Shannon's paper to stick out where I feel like, oh my gosh, of course Shannon didn't quite mean that because his mom's so awesome, therefore. So what I do to make sure that there's no bias, none of you will use your real names on the test. You will all make up a name. So I want you all to use a pseudonym so that I have no idea who you are. I don't want to know. And I used to teach just for a year, but I taught at the University of Texas at San Antonio. And there were a lot of students who were suing their professors because they were claiming they were being discriminated against because of their last names. And so when I got there, I was, okay, I can fix that easily. I don't care if their name's Martinez or Hernandez or Jones, right? I mean, it's got to be neutral. So it's a little odd. I may be the only professor on campus who does this. I'm not sure. But I want you to do that. And you'll do that for all 3 tests for me, but not the same name. You'll have to have 3 different names. You can pick whatever name you want. I generally despise country music and rap music. So I usually say, you know, country and rap is crap. So please don't, you know, but if you have to, you have to, right? I'll leave that up to you. But just know that if I see a country singer's name on the front of the page, there might be a little bias there. So just keep that in mind. No, seriously, do whatever you want. So what's that? Taylor Swift. Actually, I have never heard a Taylor Swift song. I've seen her picture, and she looks very wholesome, so that's fine. But yeah, I don't know anything about her. So, not like, oh my gosh, she was the girl. She's now older, but she's gotten in so much trouble. She was in Mean Girls. And yeah, Lindsay Lohan, right. She's dangerous. But yeah, you can use other names. Okay? Yes, Shelby.
So, what do you mean by how? Because, like, the other ones, can see how, and also how specific with when.
Yeah. So when, the more specific you can get, the better.
Okay.
So if you can tell me that Socrates was executed in 399, perfect. If you tell me, though, that he was executed within a few years after the defeat in the Peloponnesian Wars, that's fine, too. But if you say that he was born at the same time Jesus was, that's wrong.
Okay.
Right? So just get as close as you can and be as specific as you can. The how is just an explanation. Give me the framework. What's going on here?
Is that what you meant by context as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
So, does that make sense for everyone? Okay, and so look this list over. Believe it or not, I actually cut it down from last year. So, I had quite a few more terms last year, but you guys are very talkative, which is great. But that means we haven't covered quite as much. So, I took some things out just to kind of gear it towards your class. Okay, so anything else? And you can ask anytime. You can email me. whatever. But I'll see you Monday and Wednesday, and at any point you can ask questions. Lauren?
So for the short answer, will that be, again, based off of the previous terms?
No. No. The short answers can be anything. So there's really no, you don't really want to study for them. There's no reason to. Study the terms, and the short answers are just like the quizzes, basically, but maybe a little more abstract. So, yes, go ahead, Lauren.
So is it like multiple choice, or is it essay?
No, it won't be essay. It'll be a series of multiple choice and fill in the blanks. Yeah.
So the short answer is multiple choice fill in the blanks. Okay.
Sometimes, not always. Okay, good. Last thing then, you do have a quiz today. So that will be in 30 minutes, all right? But right now we're going to talk about some other things. So, okay. Yes, Bryson.
What's the quiz cover?
Lots of things. Okay, so today we're going to look at this transition here, and I had asked you to read these readings from the Hellenistic period. So what we're going to do, and this, we're moving into a new way of thinking, but we're also, for the first time in this class, 5 weeks in, we're going to see where the Jewish and the Greek come together. So I hope you had a chance to read Maccabees. Maccabees may seem a little strange to some of you. Maccabees is considered canonical among Catholics and Eastern Orthodox. Among Protestants, it's a part of the Apocrypha. So Protestants will take it as historically accurate, but not sacredly written. Catholics and Eastern Orthodox think it's both. So but it's one of those accidents of history, frankly, why, and we'll get into that later, why Protestants choose one form of the Old Testament and Catholics and Orthodox choose another. Really, there's nothing malicious there. It was truly an accident. But, yeah, sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm clarifying. Did you say Hellenistic, or this section where we see the collision of Jewish and Greek cultures?
Yes.
Or Greek? Okay.
Yeah. So that's what Maccabees is. Maccabees is explaining why the Greeks become so influential for the Jews. All right, we'll get into that in just a second. So when we think about Greece, we always call it Hellenic, which is the proper term for the time. And yet when we're talking Hellenic, we're really talking only about classical Greece when the polis is supreme, right, 150 of them, and prior to that. So Hellenic means essentially from the moment we start seeing real immigration into the Greek areas, then through Homer, and then ultimately through the death of Socrates. With the death of Socrates in 399, we really end the period that we call Hellenic. That is, what was classically Greek seems to be gone at that point. And starting sometime, we don't have an exact date, this is where I think historians maybe should get their act together a little bit better, and yet I like that there's some flexibility. Sometime between about 399 and the end of that century, with the rise of Philip of Macedon, sometime between those two things, we move into what's called the Hellenistic. And the Hellenistic, as I hope is fairly clear, is basically Greek-ish. It's Greek light, so L-I-T-E, right? So it's a, like Pepsi Light, or you know, it's a watered down Greekness. It's not the classical Greek, but it's Greek influence. So that will all come with Philip. And then especially, and we unfortunately just don't have time to talk about this in this class, though it's amazing stuff, but especially with his son, Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great is the person, he's the single most important conqueror up to this time in history. He's an evil man, but he's brilliant. He's a genius. He was a student of Aristotle. Absolute genius, but no morals at all. In fact, he helps kill his dad. And the reason he helps kill his dad is because he thinks his real father is Zeus. He's convinced of it. He doesn't think that his biological father has any real say in his life, that he was conceived by Zeus coming down to his mother. And his mother believed that too, actually, in what she taught him. So they actually murder the father at one of the daughter's weddings. That she's walking up the aisle and they stand up and kill Philip. And then Alexander, who's only about 22 at the time, becomes emperor of this whole region. So the city-state's gone. Right? It's just gone. These guys are from Macedonia, Philip and Alexander. They move south from a northern country. And one of the things they're best at, they're excellent horsemen. The best in the ancient world. And so they have not, they're not great at cavalry, excuse me, they're not great at infantry, but they're excellent at cavalry. So if they can combine Macedonian cavalry with the hoplites and the other militia groups and armies of the Greeks, this could be a really formidable thing, which it will be. But that's all going to change. So Paulus is dead. Now it's an empire, and it's become an empire through Philip and then his son, Alexander. Carly.
How was Alexander the Great influenced by Aristotle, like in his worldview or...
Yeah, that's a really debatable question.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of back and forth about it. What it seems to be, Aristotle was his tutor. So you don't imagine some really wealthy person hires the best person around to be your tutor. And that's exactly what happens. So we know for certain that Alexander really took to Aristotle's logic and to the idea of purpose, and we haven't talked about this much, but teleology, a thing becoming itself, right? Carly becoming fully Carly, the tree becoming a tree. That's what we call telos or teleology, and that's Aristotle. That's why it's a prime mover. The prime mover moves you. You then have agency to become who and what you are, but restricted within the polis. So it seems that Alexander took those aspects, but not the ethics at all, right? Not in the least. So Alexander, unless there are questions, I know I'm going quickly, but just so you know. So Alexander, when he takes over, he, is that a siren?
I don't know, that's what I was checking. I think it's a construction truck.
Okay, good. If you hear a siren, tell me. All right, I'm not sure what we do, but yeah. All right, so Alexander consolidates all of Greece. No more city-states anymore. It's become this huge part of a Macedonian Greek empire. And Alexander has this dream. Now, he's crazy, but he's brilliant. And he believes that because he's the son of God, he is to conquer the entire world in the name of Greek culture. So even though he's a Macedonian, he's not a Greek. He comes into Greece. He then solidifies all of his control. He builds a huge army, much like Persia once had 200 years earlier. Builds this absolutely huge army. And, of course, he's got his cavalry. But then he does something that is both creepy, fascinating, and brilliant all at once. He starts marching, and he marches to the east. His desire is to get all the way to the Pacific Ocean, that whole band of civilization. Remember, we talked about this, things that changed at 510. That whole band of civilization, basically from Spain all the way to the extreme eastern shore of China. He wants all of that. And he's had this dream that he's supposed to do this. So not only does he take military, but here's what makes him so incredible and weird. He takes with him all kinds of priests, you know, pagan priests. He takes with him philosophers, and he takes with him all kinds of architects and people who are very skilled in building Greek things. And so everywhere he goes, they march. And they never, by the way, they are almost completely successful until they get to India. And then they get to the border of India, the Indus River, yeah, spelled like Hindu, right? Get to the Indus River. And when they do, one of the Indian rulers at the time has created mounted elephant troops. And they come out and they face the Greeks. And this is the only time Alexander ever fails. When his men see these guys on the elephants, they've never seen elephants before. They're so utterly shocked and horrified that they turn around and Alexander cannot maintain control of the army. They start moving back west as quickly as they can. So this is, maybe this is not an expression people use that much anymore, but in the early 20th century it was still used. Turned back at the Hindu, at the Indus. That was one of the great kind of sayings. Like, we still remember crossing the Rubicon, but that one was a pretty important saying as well. Meaning there's a barrier you can't surmount. So he gets there and he has to turn back. Now, when he comes back, he marches and he decides he doesn't want to just march over the territory he's already claimed. He's going to go to the south. So he's already conquered that northern edge of civilization through Persia. Now he's going to go south, and he's going to conquer all of the Near East, places we would now call Syria, for example, or Jordan, and he gets all the way to Egypt. When he gets to Egypt, he gets a cold, and he dies. So that's a huge blow to people, because he's been projecting himself as a god. And now, of course, the god has died from the flu. And that means that this whole area he's conquered, nobody's there to rule it anymore. And it breaks down into about, depending on the time period, 3 to 5 smaller empires, all in the name of Alexander. But they're separate from one another. Okay, someone had their hand up. I'm sorry. Yeah, Bryson.
Yeah, around what time did he die?
Oh, the exact year?
Maybe not the exact.
He was 33. I can't remember exactly. I'm sorry. Yeah. I just can't remember. Yeah, sorry. It's slipping my mind at the moment. So, Shelby.
So, were there like 5 people that each claimed to be his heir?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they each claimed to be his true heir. And it was hard to know who would have had legitimacy. And it just becomes a power grab.
Right.
It would be like if the head of the mafia died and all of his sons split it up.
Right.
And that's but you're talking about a huge part of the world. Basically, all of Southern Europe, all the way to India, all the way across North Africa into Egypt. So this is a massive, it's the largest empire of its time.
Okay.
It incorporates the Persian Empire. Remember, the Persian Empire had been the largest up to that point. Now the Persian Empire is a province within
right.
this empire. So, Lauren.
So when did he begin his conquest? What year?
Yeah, again, I'm sorry, I can't, it would have been just right about 310 BC, but look it up because I can't remember the exact date. And I'm now that I've told you I can't remember, I'm not going to test you on it. Because it's not fair to you. If I don't remember, I shouldn't expect you to. Bryson, even though it would be good as an educated person to know it. All right.
When his territory broke into like four different sections, what did those empires then become known as?
Well, there are a number of different names, like the Seleucids, and there are a whole variety of different names. But here's what's important about that for us, especially for this class. So because Alexander took with him civil engineers, philosophers, priests, everywhere he went, and this was his strategy, everywhere he went, he left Greeks in those places. And he always made sure that his troops, yeah, I'd call it maybe making love, but it was probably rape, he made sure that his troops slept with all the local women so that they would impregnate them. And the reason to do this was that you're tying these people, because now you've got these traditional societies and unwed mothers, you're making it so there's a whole new population within these areas that is no longer under the traditional rules. And the only way they will be accepted is if they're seen, say, not as Persians, but as half Persians and half Greeks. And it gives them an upper edge because they become the new ruling elite. So the very last one of these to die, the very last of the children of Alexander's army, is Cleopatra. She was the last Greek princess. So we think of her as an Egyptian. She was a Greek. She's the last Greek princess that comes from this. But it also means if any of you have ever traveled to the Near East, you will find little cities that are deserted now that look like Greek palaces, because that's what Alexander builds everywhere. So what this means is the Greek language, Greek culture, and Greek religion doesn't dominate. That's not, Alexander's not, he doesn't want Greece to dominate at all. He wants to intermix it all because he's a god. And so he doesn't want to destroy their cultures, but he wants to make them half Greek. So that's, and it's genius in what he, it's utterly evil, but it's genius, right? Is that, okay. So what happens then? The people who are most affected by this for our purposes are the Jews. Because when he takes over Egypt, he also takes over all the Jewish areas. Lionel.
323 BC is when he dies.
He dies in 323?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. So he took over then in 333?
Yeah.
Okay.
That looks to be right.
Okay, good. Thanks. So not as late as I was thinking, but a little bit earlier. Thanks for looking that up.
Yeah, and that's a similar strategy the British used to try to take over Scotland and the
and India. It's a time-tested strategy, right? It works. It's, again, I think it's evil, but it works. So all of this philosophy gets taken. And I want you guys, especially now, just think about Paul for a moment. And you're going to get sick of me saying this, but it's critical. St. Paul is educated as a Greek. He's a Jew. And he's a Roman citizen. So we have to start asking, how did that happen? Where does that come from? How could that happen? How do we make sure, how do we see all this comes together? And not to be too religious about this, just for the purposes of this class, but you think about what Paul says in Galatians. When does Jesus come? He comes in the fullness of time. Doesn't just come anytime. He comes when those three cultures have become one. The Jewish, the Greek, and the Roman. It's absolutely critical. It's why he has the name Jesus, right? We talked about this briefly. Jesus is not a Jewish name. It's a Greek name. If he had a Jewish name, it would have been some form of Joshua, Yeshua, right? But he's not. He's got a Greek name. And we assume, we don't know this, but we assume that he preached not only in Aramaic, but he probably preached in what was called Koine, which was a form of kind of business Greek at the time. So all those things have to come together. And yet, what happens? So, and I love this story, and I wish we have hardly any details about it. But if you had a chance to read Maccabees, and I hope you have, you know what's going on there. It gives a nice little history of Alexander right at the beginning of Maccabees, and then it talks about what it does to the Greeks. And, you know, this is always one of those sticky subjects, but we have to say it. So the most offensive thing that the Greeks impose upon the Jews is homosexuality. And it's not just that they introduce it into the Jewish culture where it was not known. This was not a part of Jewish culture, and it would have been strictly forbidden had there even... I mean, we know it exists because it's dealt with in various parts of the Old Testament, but it's strictly forbidden in every way. So the Greeks not only introduce it as a normal thing, that it's just a part of life, but they do two other things that are really important. They always, wherever they go, the Greeks do, they build what we would call gymnasiums, where you go work out. But when you go work out, and you're Greek, you always work out in the nude, always. And so this means that if the law tells you that you have to physically work on your body, which you had to as a Greek, you had to, it was as much a part of having a good mind, you had to have the good body, it meant that all these Jews are exercising next to the Greeks, and they see who's circumcised and who's not. And I'm not going to go into any details about this, but I assume you at least saw the line that should have just freaked you out, where it said, and many Jews succumbed and uncircumcised themselves. Now, I've actually looked this up, how it would be done. I never want to think about it again, but there was a process. There was a medical process to do it. So this became, and now that is deeply offensive to most Jews, but some Jews obviously cave into this. So that's one thing that they do. So the introduction of homosexuality, and especially the notion of uncircumcision, which is a violation of the covenant too, especially for the Jews. But here's the other thing they do. They actually, the Greeks will capture Jewish boys and sell them into pedophilia slavery. So this is reprehensible in every way. And so the Jews have to fight this. And some of you may know this, but this is where the celebration of Hanukkah comes from. So there's one leader, and I think he's one of the coolest guys in all of history, though we don't know a lot about him. His name is Judah Maccabeus, and he's the patriarch of his family. And Judah, now he's going to cause problems for the Jews later as well, but it's not his fault. Judah Maccabeus sees himself as the great liberator of the Jews. He is the sword of God. And much like the Jews had fought other paganisms, they're going to fight the Greeks. And so there's a civil war right around 170 BC in which all the Jewish areas go into revolt, being led by Judah Maccabeus, the great patriarch, the great leader, incredible warrior. But they don't have enough forces to do it. So here's, I don't know if any of you, maybe this is just what nerds do, but if any of you have ever played a game or a parlor game where you imagine if you could go see any scene in history, this is the scene I would want to go to. Judah sends his sons to go to Rome. I'll get you in a second, credit. Sends his sons to go to Rome. And they actually are given an audience before the whole Roman Senate. And they go before the Roman Senate. And Rome at this time is still a republic. It's been a republic for about 300 years at this point, and the Romans have always been utterly horrified by any sexuality outside of marriage. It was, you could not in any way ever have any relations outside of man and wife. Now, that'll change completely in the Empire. In the Empire, anything goes. But in the Republic, these guys, I mean, they really make, for example, our New England Puritans look like pikers. I mean, they were that strict about it. And especially if a male, bless you, Carly, if a male ever demonstrated any effeminate qualities, there was usually exile or execution. That's how serious they were about this. So I know it's not a PC topic, but it's just a fact that the Romans and the Jews, almost alone in the ancient world, at least in the civilized world, almost alone, find this reprehensible. Most other people see homosexuality as a norm in that time, but definitely not the early Romans and the Jews. Absolutely forbidden. So, Carly.
The date of the Civil War?
So it's right around 170, and okay. We think, we don't know exactly, but we think that his sons went to the Senate in 165.
Okay,
so
you.
We think. Kenna?
So the whole, did like the myths surrounding Zeus and the other gods change then from the Roman Republic to the Roman Empire? Because there was not a lot of...
Let's hold off on that, because we'll do that. Promise, we're coming up to that. Okay, yeah, Soren.
I didn't understand very well from the text. Is it Matthias who sends his son, or is it truly the sons of Judas Maccabeus? My understanding...
It's a patriarchy, so there are a number of different people in it, but we always give credit to Judah.
To Judah,
yeah,
okay.
Always. He's always seen as the victor, and Hanukkah is after him. So Hanukkah is a celebration of Judah.
But it did start with his father, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely. He's the son. Right, but he's the one who makes it happen,
okay.
And it's his sons who go to Rome. Okay, Bryson?
Yeah, I don't know if my questions were that pertinent, but I guess I was going to ask about the Romans, as far as like the way that they viewed it, was expressing inequalities for a man that was feminine, was that due to you not being seen as a man, as a person, or that was like a slight against Rome in general?
It's a destruction of Rome's reputation. So the way, if you didn't behave as a proper man, you were slighting your community, and that was unforgivable to do that. Remember, it's a republic. It has to be the common good, and there are certain rules that you have to abide by, but it really is unusual, and I can't stress this enough, though, again, I really don't want to get into too many details about it, but among the civilized ancient people, the Romans and the Jews are the most serious, yet they develop it totally differently. Right, it comes about in different ways. So, Lionel, really quickly here, we've only got about 5 minutes.
Okay, I just don't understand why Rome would have developed that.
We'll get into that next week. It's a farming culture. It's an extremely traditional culture. The whole culture is based on hard work. And they have, I mean, whatever you want to call it, they have a traditional ethic when it comes to sexuality. Yeah, it is rigorous there. To the point, you guys, I don't think you've had to read it yet, but Cato the Elder... It's so clear in that, and I think you read that next week, but you know, Cato's so clear that this is what a man is, and that's part of republicanism, as we'll see. Being a republic is not just having a certain form of government. It is a lifestyle. It is a way of living. Okay, does that make sense for everyone?
Mm-hmm.
Great questions. I don't need to stop it. We're going to run out of time here. Okay, so here's what happens. They go to the Senate. They give. We don't have any evidence of what they said except that paragraph you have in Maccabees about it. We have no Roman records about it, except we have the bronze scrolls. And anytime the Romans did anything important, they wrote it on bronze. And so we do have the bronze scrolls that say the Jewish people and the Romans tie themselves together always in alliance forever and ever. So that's the agreement. And the Romans send some soldiers. They help the Jews. They defeat the Greeks. That's how the Jews become independent around 165 BC. But of course, anybody, what's the problem? Romans are a peacekeeping force, right? They want to get these unmanly Greeks as well. They used to call them, by the way, the term was Greeklings, if you deviated in your sexuality. That was obviously that's a translation, but it's the equivalent. So, what happens?
The Romans oppress the Jews.
Yeah, they stay. It's like, you know, you call them over to help, and they're, sure, we're going to help. Well, now their republic is much bigger, right? So they now have control. Now, they won't assert control until a century later under Pompey. And that, I mean, is neither here nor there. But what I want you to understand, and for this class specifically, the Greeks rule the Jews for well over 150 years. So this is a long time period. Obviously, we focus on the Maccabean Revolt, and again, at the end of that, the eight candles are to represent the victory over the Greeks. So at the end of that, that's what we think of. But here's the problem, and I hope this is clear for everybody. There's a reason Jesus has a Greek name. No matter how much you want to purify Jewish culture, after 150 years, you can't do it. It's impossible. No culture could do it. You can no longer say it's just Jewish culture. You still have your Jewish traditions and your Jewish beliefs, but now it's Greekified. It's become Hellenistic. So language becomes Greek, at least partially. It's not just Aramaic, right? It's not just Hebrew. And culturally, the way people eat, the way they think, Jews become a part of the larger Mediterranean world. And so this is, here. Remember, as we stressed 5 weeks ago, they're this Eastern people. And yet now they're becoming assimilated. So even in their rejection, they can reclaim their Judaism, but they cannot get rid of the Greek cultural influences that have come in. Philosophy, ideas, ways of government, they're there now. And the other thing that's really important here, now I'm sure many of you have studied this, especially if you come from a Christian background, what is it that many of the Jews wanted Jesus to be? He's the new Judah Maccabees. That's the name they use. Jesus is meant to be Judah. That's what they want. And when Jesus shows, I'm not here to overthrow the Romans, like Maccabees did to the Greeks. They're furious because obviously they're in the same situation that they had been 160 years earlier. And yet this leader, self-proclaimed in some ways not, this leader says, my kingdom's not of this world. They're freaking out. That's why you can have Palm Sunday one week, and the next week they're killing him. It's like, wait a minute, we put all of our expectations in you. You're supposed to be Judah, and now you've turned us down. Well, now you're worthless. In fact, we're going to execute you over this guy we actually know has committed a crime. We're going to let Barnabas go. You're dead. So you have to keep that in mind. But the other thing you have to keep in mind is Christianity arises in the Jewish religion, in the Greek culture, and in the Roman polity. That's the fullness of times. So we'll never understand Jesus or Paul or the rise of Christianity without recognizing all three of those things matter. Think about Paul when he walks around. They can't arrest him. He's a Roman citizen. And all he has to say, if he gets arrested, all he has to say is, I'm a Roman citizen. He doesn't even have to show papers. But by claiming that, Roman soldiers leave him alone. They let him out of prison until the end, obviously, they get him. But he's protected. So there's an interesting confluence here of all three of those things. Kenna.
Could you say those three things again, the Roman polity?
Yeah, you're going to hear it a million times. But yes, so just think of Paul. He walks on Roman roads. He knows Greek philosophy, and he's a Jew.
So like Roman polity, Greek philosophy, and Jewish faith?
Yeah, Greek culture and Jewish faith. Yeah. Yeah. So this is what we call the Hellenized world. There's another term for it, and that's cosmopolitanism.
And three things?
I'm sorry?
Those three things put together, that's cosmopolitanism?
Well, it's another name for it. We call it cosmopolitanism more loosely now. But so last thing I'm going to say today, and then I'll hand out the quiz. So I had asked you guys to read those Hellenistic philosophies, and you have a letter from Epictetus and Epicurus. They're pretty interesting. So imagine why they arise. The polis is dead in 399. And so prior to that, if you're a Greek, you belong to a city. That's your identity. Now you have no identity. And so people are really, really searching for an identity. And so what happens is you become no longer just a citizen of the polis. The polis becomes the universe. And so now you're trying to figure out your citizenship. Yeah, and for those of you who read Romans, Paul's letter to the Romans, it's nothing if not about citizenship. Layer after layer after layer of citizenship. Where does your citizenship lie? And Paul goes through about seven different types of citizenship in that. This is one of the greatest Greek questions, and the Hellenized Rome as well. Where do we have our loyalties? And so this is why, Kenna, hope this answers you, this is why they call it cosmopolitan. because you're no longer a citizen of the polis, you're a citizen of the universe. And that's where all these philosophies, like Epicureanism, Hedonism, Cynicism, and what we'll talk about next week, Stoicism, it's where they all arise. Okay, so everybody good on that? We're on the same page? Okay, so, yes, Shelby.
Is this, like, the final transition from, like, in-group ethics to philosophy?
It's getting
like,
there.
Among the common people?
The final won't be until Christianity arises.
Okay.
But, yes, it's a huge and important stage. Okay. Stoicism is the very first...